The views expressed throughout this podcast are solely those of myself and the guest and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of ATCC or any other institution. Hello and welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmosh, and this is our third and final episode in our series with Dr. Aaron Sipas. Naturally, I recommend listening to the first two episodes for the background context of this one, where we look ahead to the future of brown adipose tissue research. Dr. Sipas shares his aspirations for the field, including potential clinical applications and the next steps in his research. We'll talk about new techniques, technologies, and how these advancements could transform the treatment of metabolic diseases. So, welcome back again, Dr. Sipas. This time, we are going to focus on the future. This is always my favorite part. So, I'm going to put it to you. What does the future of NIDDK's brown adipose tissue or BAT and white adipose tissue, or I assume WAT, research look like?
Yes. I enjoy you referring to them as BAT and WAT, because when people get up and give lectures at these meetings, we like to refer to it that way. BAT sounds better, and I'm glad, because that's the area that I'm more directly involved in. But they're both good.
Yeah, I shrugged a little bit saying WAT. I wasn't
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, no, it's natural. It just doesn't sound quite the same. Because everything is, like in my lab, we've got a BAT phone. We've got, and also because I grew up watching I didn't know it was campy at the time, but the Adam West Burt Ward TV series. I took that as serious back in the 70s. So my phone still has the bat ring.
Personally, I think it holds up.
Yeah. Oh, I definitely. So to answer your question, so the NIDDK's program in bat and wet research, we have a platform and it's based on three pillars. One is integrative physiology. The second is non-invasive imaging. And the third is clinical trials. And the integrative physiology pillar is the broadest currently within our group and our collaborators. For example, we're now using these immortalized clonal human brown and white pre-adipocyte cell lines that we generated in collaboration with ATCC. And using those, it allows us to understand a number of previously undetermined aspects of adipocyte physiology. For example, we're using the cells to find out just how fluid it is, the identity of a brown versus white adipocyte. Is it dichotomous, or are there a number of states in between that have both physiological and therapeutic relevance? We're also trying to understand whether the brown adipocytes or the white adipocytes can consume more energy at baseline, or will they respond to treatments for obesity and metabolic disease? And as an example, we are now looking at the medications that people are using to treat obesity, the GLP-1 receptor agonist, the GIP receptor agonist, the glucagon receptor agonists. I mean, everybody talks about suppression of appetite or changes to this and that, but nobody's really looked at the effects on the white adipose tissue, and virtually nobody has the tools to study the brown adipose tissue. And these drugs are a little bit different in terms of what they get accomplished. And we believe, based on the data we have already, that's in part because of the way they engage the adipocyte depots. So that's something that we're working on, and that's something that will be very important for the future. We also have multiple lines of evidence to show that white and brown adipocytes are involved in bile acid metabolism. And I have to tell you, bile acid metabolism is way more fascinating than it would appear just based on a medical school curriculum. Like endocrinology in general, bile acids are misunderstood. We think of them as these salts that are released by the gallbladder and help digest fat. Well, certainly that's one of their functions, but that's at a very high concentration in the gut. When they get to the blood, and they always get 95% of the ones that are released into the gut get back into the blood, they act as hormones and they impact the immune system. They affect glucose metabolism. They affect lipoprotein metabolism and cholesterol. So we are studying how white and brown adipose tissue is involved in bile acid metabolism and how they communicate with the liver. Another thing that's really exciting is, as I mentioned, that we're trying to understand how brown adipose tissue is involved in nutrient absorption and also the microbiome composition. And that area of research was informed by some basic kind studies led by one of our colleagues, Jörg Herren, at the University of Hamburg. And we're also working with others to functionally define the different anatomic depots seen within the human white and brown adipose tissue. So, for example, there is brown adipose tissue that's very active underneath the shoulder, above the clavicle, the collarbone. There's also along the spine. There's brown adipose tissue around the kidneys. And then there's the white adipose tissue under the skin that we have a lot of. How similar are they at the gene expression level? What features do they have in common? What did these results mean for the types of roles they play in human physiology? These are the things that are going to keep us busy both now and for several years into the future.
It's going to keep me busy too, trying to not take up all of your time and learn more about these things. 95% of bile acids become hormones in the blood.
Well,
give or take.
95% of bile acids are absorbed from the gut. Only 5% are lost. They're recycled.
Right.
And the concentration of bile acids in the gut is in the millimolar level. The concentration of bile acids in the peripheral blood, not the part that goes directly to the liver, but goes past the liver, is in the micromolar level. So it's 1,000th the concentration within that region. And so now they're not acting so much as detergents to help absorb food, but they're acting as signaling molecules. And we don't really understand all the things that they're trying to do. But we do know that they have an impact on many different systems, which is not surprising because bile acids have at their core, and this is where the chemistry training comes in, they are a cholesterol ring. And that sterol ring is the basis of cholesterol, when it has 27 carbons, but then bile acids have 24 carbons. And all the hormones that everybody gets excited over, testosterone, estrogen, cortisol, all those are 21 or fewer carbons. They're all from the same structure. So anything that has that basic shape is going to be likely involved in signaling at the nuclear level and having big impacts on metabolism.
I could imagine even further. There's a sort of persistent discussion of the quote-unquote second brain or gut brain, right? And if the bile acids are released as a part of the digestive system and they are so heavily related to so many of the other biological signaling mechanisms that we know are commonly employed, like you said, testosterone, et cetera, seems at least like there's a tenuous, at least, link between the two. Yeah, yes. Like I said, I'm not going to try to soak up all of your time today and
now. I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's so much that hasn't been addressed yet in this area, partly because people didn't. It's a fun thing to see within. I've been in science long enough to know that there are many things that are unanswered, and then an area of technology will develop that was not directly related to what you're studying, but has the ability to answer questions. And now all sorts of previously unanswered questions have been addressed, leading to an entirely different part of the field. That's how brown adipose tissue was discovered to begin with. People could not examine it except by taking samples in certain places, and it led to people misunderstanding its role in physiology. Then PET CT is implemented for the purpose of doing disease surveillance for cancer, because one can take a CT scan, which is a three-dimensional CAT scan, and then by the early 2000s, fuse that image with a PET scan, which is giving information about where a tracer like glucose is going. Fuse them together, and you get the metabolic activity of all the organs in the body. You can see, is the Hodgkin's disease still there? Is there a tumor that's deep inside the lung that one couldn't see through any other process? And then it turned out, oh, look, there was some metabolically active fat that wasn't like any other. And then those of us who were paying attention said, wait a minute, that's brown fat. That's actually functional. And that could be very relevant. So that's how these things happen. And every time this comes with new technologies, we have to then say, okay, what will this help us answer in our particular field?
You've preempted my next question. I was going to ask about the recent technological developments or the emerging technological developments, and I will ask you about that. When was the PET and CT scan applied to this field first? Was that within the last decade, two decades?
So the first papers came out in 2002, 2003.
Okay, about 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's when the radiologists first published their paper. Richard Wall, von Schultes, they said, there is this metabolically active adipose tissue, probably brown adipose tissue, that is seen in people who were trying to do cancer surveillance. And for the radiologist perspective, it was not helpful to see the brown adipose tissue because it got in the way of seeing tumors. So the radiologists spent the next few years finding ways to suppress its activity to then do what they needed to do. However, that was a literature that wasn't being read by the endocrinologists or right. metabolism experts because it's very esoteric. I got into it because I was an endocrine fellow, and it was my job for the second third of the year to run the seminar series that started at 8 a.m. I have to get there at like 7 in the morning, set up the projector, all that kind of stuff. So it was during that time that Dr. Tony Parker was giving us a lecture about endocrine applications for nuclear medicine. And he was talking about iodine-131. And for whatever reason, he showed a picture of an FDG PET-CT. And again, whatever motivated him to say, oh, and there's the brown fat. And I went up to him and I said, Dr. Parker, there is no brown fat in adult humans. Well, I didn't think there was. And he said, oh, we see it all the time. And that's how we got into this field. I went back to my mentor, Ron Kahn. I said, Ron, did you know there's brown fat in adults? And he said, no, we better prove that. And that's what led us to go in this area. So it started, the real rediscovery of the tissue as functional was in 2002, 2003. And then our paper and the others in the New England Journal of Medicine were published in April of 2009. So about 6-7 years from the original publications to the publication where then shift and everybody started getting into it. But that's one area. And then imaging continues to be an area of refinement because it's the only way to see the tissue at a whole body level. As opposed to, for example, we know where the liver is and you can really study the liver in one zone. And one can do the same thing with many other solid organs. Brown adipose tissue is a different kind of solid organ, like white adipose tissue. It's spread throughout the body. So if you really want to understand it, you need whole body imaging.
And would that be now the modern PET scan or the CT scan? Are you doing MRIs?
Well, PET CT is very helpful. The big problem with PET CT is that it involves a certain amount of ionizing radiation. So you can't do that many scans. You can't recruit children. And there's only a certain number of tracers that one has easily accessible to learn about the physiology. So we are trying to move over to incorporating and maybe, if not replace, but focus on using magnetic resonance-based procedures, MRI or magnetic resonance spectroscopy. Literally this afternoon, I was participating in what's called a BAT chat. A number of colleagues of mine, led by Ed Melanson in the University of Colorado, all of us from all over the world will talk about different kinds of research. And today was a discussion of magnetic resonance-based imaging of human brown adipose tissue. So we're trying to move in that area. It's far more complicated to use MRI to study anything than it is to use PET CT. I think they'll probably be used together to give different information about the processes.
What variety of, so forgive me, my chemistry background, I think of MRIs more as NMRs.
Right.
And even then, the type of spectra that I was deconvoluting were, nosy and cozy, two-dimensional, which I found to be a blast, but I can't imagine how that necessarily adapts to full tissues.
I wish I could tell you at an intuitive level how it's done. But yes, I was exposed, just as you were in chemistry, to a one-dimensional NMR spectrum where, you have the chemical shift and water's over here, and then there's... That's how I understood. And then to find out that someone could take the same basic hydrogen behavior and then turn that into a three-dimensional image of the body was mind-blowing. I'm still amazed by that. That was right. That Nobel Prize definitely earned. Now,
right, I know that's true, but
right.
It's still baffling.
I trust it. But we do use that. So the magnetic resonance spectroscopy gets back to the more closer to the classical understanding of like a unidimensional spectrum. One can see a peak, for example, from a particular, like lactate, for example. And you can see how the peak for lactate can be higher or lower depending on how metabolically active a tissue is and things of that nature. We just published a paper looking at creatinine's behavior to get a sense of one aspect of feudal cycling. There are many ways that brown fat may generate heat, and one of them is through creatinine feudal cycling. And now one can use magnetic resonance spectroscopy to get a window into that. So I love where okay. this is going. I think and it's an area obviously where you have technology is moving very, very fast by people who have are not restricted by the knowledge base that I have in medicine. They're really just can focus on getting the technology there. And so I think that is where the imaging is going to really make its great advances within the next 5, 10, 20 years is within magnetic resonance-based imaging. So at the whole body level, that's where it's going to be. I think PET CT is quite mature, to be polite about it.
Well, at least PET CTs, if I remember correctly, still have going for them that they are the only imaging methodology that uses antimatter.
Yes. Funny you mention that. I like to tell our team about that. Yes.
I love saying that.
There are, and not just that, but if you've seen, well, there are movies that involve characters who do experiments with antimatter, and it doesn't go so well for Dr. Banner, but people like us who follow the rules described by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission can do actually very effective research. Yeah. So yes, we do use antimatter, and I like to show the post-baccalaureate fellows Feynman diagrams showing how the weak nuclear force is directly relevant for what we're trying to do to study brown adipose tissue function.
Yeah, that must throw them for a loop the first time that you introduce that.
Oh, I'm sure they love it.
I certainly would anyway. So you did make mention of clinical trials being one of the three pillars, correct?
Yes.
So I understand that you are working on a drug. You've described this in brief detail. So what do you, I don't know if you could put a number to it, when this could be considered for, if it's not already, live human clinical trials and ultimately what I assume would be FDA regulation and pharmaceutical distribution. But is that a type of goal? And in this case, are you looking more for the obesity treatments, diabetes treatments, both, neither?
All right. Great question. So we use a medication called mirabegron. It's known as Mirbetric. And we use it as, and we have no relationship to the company that makes it called Astellas Pharma. All of our research, and that was the ability to get an IND and to use a medication without the control of the original pharmaceutical company was what I gained from the clinical investigator training program. So Astellas never knew about our research, which was actually kind of fun when they found out. so we currently see mirabegron. It's really a tool for understanding human bat physiology, and it's more for that than really as a, ultimately as a clinical tool. And the principal reason is that the doses of mirabegron required to activate bat are too high and produce comparatively mild, yet nevertheless unacceptably high cardiovascular responses. Specifically, the heart rate goes too high. Now, I've used ephedrine in some of our research, and that causes very high increases in heart rate and blood pressure with limited effect on the bat. So mirabegron does a great effect on activating brown adipose tissue. Now, there are two ways that this could change. One is that we found a second or even third intervention that could boost the effects of mirabegron on the brown fat while using a lower FDA-approved dose. And we are currently testing a particular nutritional supplement called alpha-lipoic acid, which we've shown in the basic science models that it has anti-inflammatory and antioxidant effects, and it may be able to be, we're testing it concurrently with mirabegron, and we'll see if a lower dose of mirabegron when combined with alpha-lipoic acid, maybe we'll get the same activation of brown adipose tissue and the same kind of metabolic benefits. Now, another approach is to use a different medication in the same class of mirabegron, which is the beta-3 adrenergic receptor agonist, and instead of mirabegron, use a medication that has a higher selectivity for the relatively sparsely expressed beta-3 adrenergic receptor, and one of them would be something called vibegron. We haven't moved into that area yet. So we really use mirabegron for the purpose of understanding the physiology, and we're a few steps from taking mirabegron and being able to use it in a clinical setting, but it's something we do keep our eye on for the future.
I see. That makes sense. And it is certainly important to do what you can with it now while keeping an eye on, I don't want to say keeping an eye on the prize necessarily, because there are plenty of prizes between here and pharmaceuticals. Out of curiosity, out of all that you have achieved, all that you've built, all that you've discovered, especially with regard to brown adipose tissue, what's left for your achievements? What's left for your research? Is there some white whale that you're chasing in specifics?
I think that the biggest single kind of goal that we have for our research program is to find a way to activate or otherwise engage brown fat such that it leads to metabolic benefits that are meaningful for people. We're going to get a clinical benefit from it. That's what I would love to see before my career ends, so that someday one can say, well, if we activate the brown adipose tissue, X, Y, and Z occurs, and now we've reduced insulin resistance in people, or we've improved their cholesterol profile so that they get less cardiovascular disease, or that we've reduced the frequency of gallstone formation because of what we've done. That is what I would love to see, and that's my ultimate goal, is to take this tissue, which no one even thought was really functional, and now use it to help people in the general public.
Excellent. Well, I expect that you'll do just that, as you've done everything else with regards to BAT and WAT. And with that, I wanted to thank you one last time for joining us. This has been a truly fascinating set of episodes for me personally, and I can promise that it will translate to the audience as well.
Well, thank you. It's been a delight speaking with you. You've anticipated like the kinds of questions that have been keeping us busy and really engaging our minds. And really, I'm not just speaking for me. I work with a large team of individuals, and I appreciate your commenting about what I've accomplished. But it really is only possible thanks to the dozens of individuals with whom we've collaborated back in Boston and now here at the NIDDK, and then our collaborators within the NIH and throughout the world. It really is a team effort, and I'm glad to be one of the representatives of that team.
And I know she's not here right now, but Amy Rees did want to say hello. It's been great working with you there as well.
Oh, Amy, I got it. We are still working with Amy and her team. We've got one manuscript related to the different kinds of adipose tissue depots in the body. We have this paper that we're writing. Literally, I got the discussion that popped up into my screen before, where our collaboration with ATCC and the bioinformatics group with Amy Rees and Jonathan Jacobs and the other people who were in that group, we now understand the brown adipocytes and white adipocytes behavior through the RNA-seq. And we didn't talk, it's like one thing I would have wanted to bring up, or just to say that besides the imaging, it's the bioinformatics techniques based on RNA-seq now, but other mass spec and others in the future. That is where a whole other area of discovery has come from, is coming from, and will be coming from in the future. That is, it's imaging on one side, and then it's bioinformatics on the other. That is the future of this field.
Yeah, we didn't get into it, but the gene expression work that Amy's been doing with your team and the rest of NIDDK has actually inspired some of the work that I'm doing on my own project.
Oh, great!
For an entirely different purpose, has nothing to do with adipose tissue in the slightest. It's purely microbial, but it's been personally beneficial to me. So anyway, thank you very much. And I'll let her know you said hello until she listens to the episode in a couple months.
Great.
And with that, I hope you have a great rest of your day and a great rest of the week at this early stage.
All right. Let me know if there's anything you need or clarifications. And I really appreciate you taking the time. It's an honor and much appreciated.
Absolutely. Dr. Aaron Seipis is a leader in the field of endocrinology, bringing a new insight and discovering a wealth of new connections between previously overlooked tissues and pathways. The story of brown adipose tissue is far from written, but he's giving us new chapters to advance our understanding. Dr. Seipis' vision for the future of brown adipose tissue research holds great promise for improving human health, especially with the adoption of new scanning techniques so he can investigate the effects of drugs such as mirabegron. This concludes our series with Dr. Aaron Seipis, but stay tuned for more discussions with experts across the myriad of biological fields with the next set of Behind the Biology.